Now, these terms were supposed to be, these eights were supposed to be nice, even, pretty-looking figures. In other words, if you had had a smoke tank on the bottom of the plane and spewed out smoke as you did this maneuver when you were through, you should have had a nice-looking figure eight left behind you, discounting the wind, of course. But that wasn't all that easy, because as you climbed up to make one of these turns, as an airplane slows down, then the trim shifts, and you have to adjust for that. And as you went over the top, you were almost in a stall, and you had to take account of that. Then as you dove down for the next half of the eight, the thing picked up speed, and the trim changed all over again. And it was a much more complicated maneuver to perform properly than it seems. And there again, the wind would throw you off some, though I don't think the wind really made too much difference on that, because you weren't working off an object on the ground. We also had a spell of doing things that were called stages. Now, I don't remember much about stages except that there was a 360 degree stage, overhead stage, and that meant you flew over the field right in the same direction you would fly if you were going to land. And when you got right over the place you expected to touch down, you must chop the throttle back all the way to idle and make a 360 degree turn without power and land about where you were supposed to. And you'd have to practice doing those, turning to the left, and then you'd have to practice them, do them to the right. And if you didn't judge it just right, if you were too high or too low or too slow or too fast or didn't allow for the wind properly, you weren't going to make it. And there was always an instructor pilot on the ground watching what you were doing and making notes. These airplanes were numbered, and everybody, it was a matter of record who was flying which numbered aircraft. And later these things went back and his judgments were written down. You did it poorly or did it well or whatever. Then there was a 180 degree overhead stage, and I don't know what that was exactly. Maybe it wasn't an overhead stage. Maybe it was just a 180-degree stage. You just flew downwind and chopped the throttle and came in and landed. But they had a variety of these little gimmicks that you had to learn to do. There were more things later, but I've said enough right now, I think. Incidentally, we were given at certain intervals check rides. Now, the first check ride you ever got was given by the chief instructor, who was a civilian. And he was a rather nice man. He was humorless and so forth, or pretended to be, but he didn't holler at you. And when that time came, I don't remember having any trouble with it at all. But if you had trouble at any of those times, you were in trouble. I think the idea probably was to wash out all the incompetence, those who, by incompetent, I mean just weren't making good pilot candidates, to get rid of them the earlier the better, before they'd wasted any more time and money on them. The rest of the check rides were given by the military pilots, and as I said before, some of them were all right and some weren't. And the worst one there was a man named Lieutenant Forager. He was a hateful, mean son of a bitch if there ever was one. And his technique was just to scream and holler at you all the time. He was a bully, that's what he was. And he was a loudmouth thing, and he was ugly, furthermore. Anyway, that's not yet a part of this story. Some of the other people that I knew at Camden, other than my friends from Maxwell Field, there was a man from Louisiana named Bob Bennett, and he was a tall, slim, very blonde man, year or two older than I probably, very soft-spoken, very gentle, very good-looking, I thought, and very nice. And his closest friend was another boy from Louisiana who was quite the opposite as far as looks are concerned from Bennett. His name was Bostick. I forget his first name. And I believe that Bostick was later killed in a B-25 in North Africa. I think so. But anyway, Bostick was one of those people, and he was a big, he wasn't fat, he couldn't have been fat, but he was big, burly, ugly, sort of Ernest Borgnine type looking man, and coarse talking and coarse looking. But as happened a number of times in my life, especially in my military life, it seemed that somehow I was the special object of those big, burly types, and they always felt it necessary to assume a protective role towards me. And Bostick was the first one who did that, and he sort of looked after me and made a special point. He always called me the pickle. Now, pickle this and pickle that. Bostick had a car. And I remember one night, Bostick in the driver's seat and Bennett in the passenger seat and me in the middle between them in front, and two other cadets whose names I don't at all remember now. I'm not even sure that I knew them then. In the back seat, and we were going to town or someplace, so we drove in. Most people didn't have a car, and so Bostick having a car, that was great. And we let these two guys in the back seat out, and I don't know where we went. Maybe we went to the movies or something, I don't know. But it was quite late at night eventually, and we all, the three of us, Bostick and me and Bennett, were back in the car. And Bostick took it into his head to go over to visit his girl, who lived in Camden or somewhere around. And so he went over to her house and parked and left Bennett and me in the car. And he went in to see this girl. And I don't remember much about it other than Bennett saying to me, "I wonder if he's getting into her pants. He said he says he isn't, but I think he's lying." Anyway, it was very late by that time, midnight or whatever. Anyway, I was sleepy, and by the time Bostick came back and got in the car, I was half asleep. And old Bostick got in there and started to drive off. We had to pick up these other two guys, and we did. We picked them up somewhere by prearrangement, I guess, and they got in the back. And I remember Bostick admonishing these two cadets. He said, "The pickle's asleep up here. The first one of you that wakes him up is going to get it from me. Now, don't you talk and don't you make any noise. The pickle's asleep. You leave him alone." And about that time, in a sort of protective manner, Bennett reached over and put his arm around me, and I just leaned against him. Of course, I was wide awake, and by that time I was wide awake there ever, but I wasn't going to let on. And I just lay there up against Bennett, who was holding me with one arm, and pretended to be asleep. And Bostick drove all the way back, but every few miles he had admonished those guys in the back, "Keep quiet and don't wake up the pickle." I remember that incident. Sometimes I think I did a few things that were somewhat bolder than were prudent, and were bolder than most of the other cadets were willing to do. And one day I took it into my head to see how high I could go. My aim was to go up to 10,000 feet. Now, I mentioned that the mixture controls on these planes were wired in the full rich position, and the instructor, one of the instructors, ground and school instructors, told us once that you couldn't get a PT-17 up to 10,000 feet. Well, I seemed to be doing all right, and I got up least to 9,800 indicated, and of course I had never been so high in the air before. That was tremendously thrilling, and but I felt very guilty about all this because A, it was against regulations. There was some altitude limit beyond which you were not to fly. And the second place, I, instead of doing practicing maneuvers, I was more or less wasting time. I also remember that on my way back down, I saw a P-39. He wasn't terribly close to me, but we were at the same altitude, and he went scooting by, and that was extremely exciting. And, of course, when I got on the ground, I couldn't resist, couldn't wait to tell everybody, and I was sort of a... in a very minor sort of way, the local hero. Pickle's been to 10,000 feet. And I took great care that this should not reach the ears of my instructor, Mr. Howard, because he positively wouldn't have approved, and I wouldn't have blamed him either. My first military check ride came from a new instructor pilot, a Lieutenant Behrens, who was a very mild-mannered, soft-spoken gentleman. And I didn't have any trouble with him at all. I don't recall having any. And the whole incident, I passed it, and the whole incident passed without comment. But that was going to be the last of those pleasant experiences of that sort. By this time, the accelerated training schedule was beginning to take its toll amongst the cadets, And more and more of them were being washed out, not every day, of course, but every week. And needless to say, this made people apprehensive. I remember that on one Sunday, Smitty and I, at his instigation, I'm sure, and some others perhaps, but at least the two of us, took it into our heads to go to church, and we didn't have any special, I don't know, we went to some church. Well, I think it was a Methodist or Presbyterian church or something, it doesn't matter, but the minute church was over, some ladies came up to us, not young ladies, but ladies, local ladies, and invited us to dinner, and we accepted and had a very nice time, too. And it happened that we were invited back, and I remember having several, three or four delightful Sunday dinners at these people's house. And I have neglected to say in the past, the same thing happened when we were at Montgomery. We went to church, and we were immediately invited to dinner at some people's house. Turned out that these people were friends of one of my English instructors at William and Mary. He was also from Alabama, and you know, that was sort of nice. But you did get the feeling, I don't think we quite realized it at the time, I didn't, that most of the people around there, the civilians, the townspeople, were in a very patriotic mood, and they were out to do anything they could to be nice to servicemen, and I must say they succeeded very well in that. They had some pleasant times, and also that was a change of diet and home-cooked meals and all. That was very nice. I enjoyed that. I suppose now is about the time to relate a certain episode, which, to be truthful, I'm tired of telling about, and I hope this is the last time I'm going to have to do it. Along about this time, we began to get a little time off on Sundays and such like, and could be gone overnight. And I think probably it was D'Azevedo and Joe Hensler and a boy named McCain and perhaps a few others decided to go to Columbia, South Carolina, which was about 30 miles away, on Saturday night and spend the night and come back on Sunday. And they invited me to go with them. And as I previously said, I think De Acevedo had a car, so I'm sure he's the one who drove, though I don't precisely remember. Anyway, I had some shopping I wanted to do. Specifically, I wanted to buy a camera. I'd never had owned a camera, and I wanted one, and I had some money, and I thought, well, this is the time to do that. And probably I had other things I wanted to do, whereas the other guys had things they wanted to do. But we did agree to meet for dinner at some well-known hotel or other in Columbia. So we got to Columbia, and they let me out, and they went their way, and I went mine, and I've shopped around, and I bought a camera, and I don't know what else I did, but it was January by then. The days were short. It began to get dark, and it was quite cold. And I decided it was high time that I found myself a hotel room before I met my friends, because I need to have a place to stay. And I wanted that taken care of first. So I perhaps went to a couple hotels, I don't know, but they were all full. And I began to get a little desperate. It seemed there was some sort of convention in town or something like that, and there was no room at any of the inns. And I remember then I got myself a handful of nickels. In those days you could telephone and a payphone for a nickel. And I got out to the Yellow Pages or something and went to the hotel listings and just started calling hotels down the list, and got the same answer from all of them. They'd had no room that night at all. But finally I did come to one hotel, and they said yes, they had a room and they would save it for me if I would come right over. So I went right over. It was a dreadful looking place. It was a storefront, really, on the street level. And you went in, and as soon as you got inside, there was the room there was two stories high, and a balcony ran around three sides of the second floor, and a staircase went up in the middle, straight up from the door up to the second story. And I went up there, and there were women sitting around in chairs to whom I paid no attention. I was rather desperate by this time because I was perilously close to being late for my appointment with the other guys, and I just wanted to get this matter taken care of and go. And I suppose I paid, and I was taken to this room, and it struck me at the time as rather odd because there was no doorknob on the place at all, just a hasp or something. But I wasn't in a mood to fuss around, and I hastily thanked them and all and left. And I suppose it was due to my guardian angel that what little luggage I had, I did not leave. I took it with me. Well, let me, when I went out on the street, I was immediately stopped by the military police. And they said, you have to come with us. And I said, what for? And they said, well, you've just been in a whorehouse, and it's off limits. And since you've been in there, then we're required to take you downtown to a pro station. Now, most of my listeners probably don't know what a pro station was. The Army used to take delight, it seemed to me, in in regular intervals, showing us this same movie over and over again, movie on the dangers and perils of venereal disease. And they showed these graphic pictures of all the nasty sores on people's penises and things. It was an awful mess. And they, of course, they didn't have sulfa drugs and that stuff in those days, or penicillin anyway. And I forget what you had to do to combat these things once you'd been exposed or had them, but the treatment was very painful, and they made all this quite graphic. So the thing you were supposed to do if you had been exposed and knew it and you had any sense was to go immediately to a military PRO, which stood for prophylactic station, and get this nasty treatment and hope that you had warded off this evil thing. So that was what they were intending to do to me, and I had those movies well in mind, and I had no wish to go through this ordeal. However, they insisted and put me in a wagon along with a bunch of other people and drove somewhere to sort of like the... It was probably the Columbia Maine Police Station, I don't know. And they put me in a big room, huge room, filled with benches, where there were a large number of drunks and vagabonds and ne'er-do-wells and dreadful-looking people sitting all around in various states of inebriation and despair and hunger and cold and I don't know what all. And they let me sit. Well, I learned something that day. Other than the obvious, I learned that I had something going for me which I was not aware of. And that was the fact that aviation cadets wore officers' clothes. The only difference was in the insignia on the cap, and we had no insignia on our shoulders. And most enlisted men, not even the military police, knew what this insignia meant, and because of the clothes, they took us for officers and were intimidated. But I didn't know that quite yet. And the whole experience was quite humiliating, I found, and of course I was late for my appointment, and I was scared, and I was mad a little bit too, I suppose, and I felt like a fool in the third place. Well, eventually some great big master sergeant, resplendent in his attire, came out and sat down beside me, and he kept asking me, and I was too dumb to know what was going on, he kept asking me what rank I was, and I just, like a prisoner of war reciting his name, rank, and serial number, I simply said, I'm an aviation cadet. And he said, but what rank are you? And I said, I'm an aviation cadet. And I just kept up that litany. And after a short time, he gave up on that. But it was clear that he was trying to find out whether I was an officer or not. And I assume from that that if an officer goes into a whorehouse, which is off limits, they don't bother him. I don't know. Anyway, he gave me a long appraising look and said, are you sure you didn't have anything to do with them women? Any of them women? And I assured him I had not, and I hadn't. And he said, well, I think we'd better take you back downtown. So he disappeared, and a few minutes later, two city policemen came out and took me in the police car downtown. I think maybe they took me to the hotel where my friends were to meet me, or I was to meet them. I don't know. But anyway, they took me downtown, let me out, and I went to the hotel, and explained why I was late. And these guys, of course, went into hysterical laughter over this tale. Everybody was a little drunk, or if not immediately, we soon were. And then to cap all this off, one of them said, you damn fool, he said, I told you before you got out of the car that we would have a room for you at the hotel here. I told you that. You had no need to go looking for a hotel room. Well, that was the end of that. But it wasn't the end of the story, because we went back to Camden the next day, and it didn't take any time at all for that story to get all over the place. And the next night, when dinner was over and everybody had left the mess hall, amidst a good deal of hilarity, as I recall, but I don't know, my old friend Bostick, whom I mentioned earlier, was sitting there. There was nobody left in the mess hall, I think, or practically nobody, but me and him, and he was way up front somewhere. And he was laughing. He was laughing until the tears were streaming down his face. He was incoherent. He was so amused. And he kept this up for a long time before he was able to get himself under control. And I don't suppose it's necessary for me to tell you what he was laughing at. And that story never left me. It even followed me to Australia. It followed me to New Guinea. I had a CO there in the 7th Squadron, George Manning, who regularly called me Whorehouse. That's always how he referred to me, Whorehouse. I had another CO in Australia who always called me Whorehouse Harry. And there was no way, apparently, I was ever to get rid of that damn story. Well, by this time, the upper class of cadets had graduated, or at least left the Southern Aviation School and had gone on to basic flying school, and we moved out of the barracks into the more high-class ones, where we had only four to a room and a bathroom between every two rooms, and it was all quite a bit nicer. And there did, I believe, come there a lower class, but we had little time for them, and I don't remember them at all, and certainly don't remember paying any attention to any of them, though they were Americans and could have been given a bad time, I suppose. I don't think I was much interested in that. It was also along about this time that I began to run into serious trouble. By this time, we were into acrobatics. And for the most part, spins and snap rolls and loops and immelmans and those things, I didn't have any particular trouble with. They aren't very hard in the first place. But when it came to slow rolls, I simply wasn't able to do it. And no matter how many times I tried, and I tried many, they never came out right. A slow roll, when it's done properly, is a roll in which you roll the airplane completely around. And you're not supposed to lose or gain altitude while you do it, and you're not supposed to scoop out at the bottom, and it's complicated by the fact that when you're up on your side, the rudder becomes the elevator, and the elevator becomes the rudder, and the ailerons work backwards, and then when you're upside down, you push the stick forward, and you go up, and you pull it back, and you go down, and then you get over onto the other side, and everything is reversed again, and all the time you're moving, and these movements keep changing. It's complicated and hard to do, and I must say, from my observations and years later, most people don't do them very well, but they can do an acceptable one, and I couldn't even do that. And my instructor, Mr. Howard, I think, lost patience with me, and I don't think I blamed him much either. But I went up for a check ride with somebody or other and was written up badly, and Mr. Howard went to a great deal of effort. And finally, one day, he just said to me, "Now, look here. You come out here and get in this airplane. I want to show you something. Now, take the stick in your hand. Now, here, you follow me and do just what I tell you. This is the motion. These are the motions you must make with the stick and the rudders to do this maneuver. And once you get them down a little bit, you sit there and you keep doing them until you can do them with your eyes closed. You can do them in your sleep. And then when you get in the air, just go through those same motions. Well, I did that. I did it several times, and I sat in that cockpit for great lengths of time, going through those motions carefully and slowly until I figured I had it probably pretty well down. So the next time Mr. Howard and I went up for a flight, he got up there and he said, now do me, he always said, do me this, do me a 360, do me a 180, do me a loop. He said, do me a slow roll. So I went through the motions I had been practicing and came out, and he looked at me in the rear view mirror and said, I thought you told me you couldn't do that. He said, do another one. So I did another one. Then he looked up at the mirror again. He kind of grinned. And he said, now what's wrong with that? Do another and another and another. Well, I had conquered that boo-boo. But I would imagine that by this time I had undergone a considerable loss of self-confidence. And check rides were coming.